We'd have read it if we weren't supposed to.
When did you look at it?
The Monday after he got it. Rumours were really picking up by then, because Christian Fisher had rung about 50 people over the weekend and read bits of the book over the phone. I've heard he scanned it and started emailing parts around as well.
This would have been before lawyers started getting involved.
Yeah. They called us all together and gave us this ridiculous speech about what would happen if we talked about the book. It was just nonsense, trying to tell us the company's reputation would suffer if the CEO's ridiculed. We're about to go public, or that's the rumour, and ultimately our jobs would be imperiled. I don't know how the lawyer kept a straight face saying it. My dad's a QC, she went on airily, and he says Child will have a hard time going after any of us when so many people outside the company know.
Is he a good CEO, Chard? Asked Strike.
Well, I suppose so, she said restlessly. But he's quite mysterious and dignified, so. Well, it's just funny what Quine wrote about him.
Which was?
Well, in the book, Chard's called Phallus Impudicus and...
Strike choked on his pint.
Nina giggled.
He's called Impudent Cock?
Strike asked, laughing, wiping his mouth on the back of his hand. Nina laughed, a surprisingly dirty cackle for one who looked like an eager schoolgirl.
You did Latin. I gave it up. I hated it. But we all know what phallus is, right?
I had to look it up, and Phallus Impudicus is actually the proper name for a toadstool called Stinkhorn. Apparently they smell vile and... well... She giggled some more. They look like rotting knobs. Classic Owen. Dirty names and everyone with their bits out.
And what does Phallus Impudicus get up to?
Well, he walks like Daniel, talks like Daniel, looks like Daniel, and he enjoys a spot of necrophilia with a handsome writer he's murdered. It's really gory and disgusting. Gerard always says Owen thinks the day wasted if he hasn't made his readers gag at least twice. Poor Jerry, she added quietly.
Why poor Jerry? Asked Strike.
He's in the book as well.
And what kind of phallus is he?
Nina giggled again. I couldn't tell you. I didn't read the bit about Jerry. I just flicked through to find Daniel because everyone said it was so gross and funny. Jerry was only out of his office half an hour, so I didn't have much time. But we all know he's in there because Daniel hauled Jerry in, made him meet the lawyers and add his name to all the stupid emails telling us the sky will fall in if we talk about Bombix Mori. I suppose it makes Daniel feel better that Owen's attacked Jerry too. He knows everyone loves Jerry, so I expect he thinks we'll all keep our mouths shut to protect him. God knows why Quine's gone for Jerry, though, Nina added, her smile fading a little. Because Jerry hasn't got an enemy in the world. Owen is a bastard, really, she added as a quiet afterthought, staring down at her empty wine glass.
Want another drink?
Strike asked.
He returned to the bar. There was a stuffed grey parrot in a glass case on the wall opposite. It was the only bit of genuine whimsy he could see, and he was prepared, in his mood of tolerance for this authentic bit of old London, to do it the courtesy of assuming that it had once squawked and chatted within these walls, and had not been bought as a mangy accessory.
"You know Quine's gone missing?" Strike asked, once back beside Nina.
"Yeah, I heard a rumour. I'm not surprised the fuss he's caused.
Do you know Quine?
Not really. He comes into the office sometimes and tries to flirt, you know, with his stupid cloak draped round him, showing off, always trying to shock. I think he's a bit pathetic, and I've always hated his books. Jerry persuaded me to read Hobart's Sin, and I thought it was dreadful.
Do you know if anyone's heard from Quine lately?
Not that I know of, said Nina.
And no one knows why he wrote a book that was bound to get him sued.
Everyone assumes he's had a major row with Daniel. He rows with everyone in the end. He's been with God knows how many publishers over the years. I heard Daniel only publishes Owen because he thinks it makes it look as though Owen's forgiven him for being awful to Joe North. Owen and Daniel don't really like each other. That's common knowledge.
Strike remembered the image of the beautiful young blonde man hanging on Elizabeth Tassel's wall. How was Chard awful to North?
I'm a bit vague on the details, said Nina, but I know he was. I know Owen swore he'd never work for Daniel, but
But then he ran through nearly every other publisher, so he had to pretend he'd been wrong about Daniel, and Daniel took him on because he thought it made him look good. That's what everyone says, anyway.
And has Quine rowed with Jerry Waldegrave, to your knowledge?
No, which is what's so bizarre. Why attack Jerry? He's lovely. Although, from what I've heard, you can't really...
For the first time, as far as Strike could tell, she considered what she was about to say before proceeding a little more soberly.
Well, you can't really tell what Owen's getting at in the bit about Jerry, and as I say, I haven't read it. But Owen's done over loads of people, Nina went on. I heard his own wife's in there, and apparently he's been vile about Liz Tassel, who might be a bitch, but everyone knows she's stuck by Owen through thick and thin. Liz'll never be able to place anything with Ropichard again. Everyone's furious at her. I know she was disinvited for tonight on Daniel's orders. Pretty humiliating. And there's supposed to be a party for Larry Pinkelman, one of her other authors, in a couple of weeks, and they can't uninvite her from that. Larry's such an old sweetheart. Everyone loves him. But God knows what reception she'll get if she turns up.
Anyway, said Nina, shaking back her light brown fringe and changing the subject abruptly,
how are you and I supposed to know each other once we get to the party? Are you my boyfriend or what?
Are partners allowed at this thing?
Yeah, but I haven't told anyone I'm seeing you, so we can't have been going out long. We'll say we got together at a party last weekend, okay?
Strike heard, with almost identical amounts of disquiet and gratified vanity, the enthusiasm with which she suggested a fictional tryst.
Need a pee before we go, he said, raising himself heavily from the wooden bench as she drained her third glass.
The stairs down to the bathroom in Ye Olde Cheddar Cheese were vertiginous, and the ceiling so low that he smacked his head even while stooping. As he rubbed his temple, swearing under his breath, it seemed to Strike that he had just been given a divine clout over the head to remind him what was, and what was not, a good idea.
Chapter 13. It is reported you possess a book wherein you have quoted by intelligence the names of all notorious offenders lurking about the city. John Webster, The White Devil. Experience had taught Strike that there was a certain type of woman to whom he was unusually attractive. Their common characteristics were intelligence and the flickering intensity of badly wired lamps. They were often attractive, and usually, as his very oldest friend, Dave Polworth, liked to put it, total fucking flakes. Precisely what it was about him that attracted the type, Strike had never taken the time to consider, although Polworth, a man of many pithy theories, took the view that such women, nervy, overbred, were subconsciously looking for what he called cart horse blood. Strike's ex-fiancée, Charlotte, might have been said to be queen of the species. Beautiful, clever, volatile, and damaged, she had returned again and again to Strike in the face of familial opposition and her friends' barely veiled disgust. He had finally put an end to 16 years of their on-again, off-again relationship in March, and she had become engaged almost immediately to the ex-boyfriend from whom Strike, so many years ago in Oxford, had won her. Barring one exceptional night since, Strike's love life had been voluntarily barren. Work had virtually filled every waking hour, and he had successfully resisted advances, subtle or overt, from the likes of his glamorous brunette client, soon to be divorcees, with time to kill and loneliness to assuage. But there was always the dangerous urge to submit, to brave complications for a night or two of consolation, and now Nina Lascelles was hurrying along beside him in the dark Strand, taking two strides to his one, and informing him of her exact address in St. John's Wood, "So it looks like you've been there." She barely came up to his shoulder, and Strike had never found very small women attractive. Her torrent of chat about Ropichard was laden with more laughter than was strictly necessary, and once or twice she touched his arm to emphasize a point. "Here we are," she said at last, as they approached a tall modern building with a revolving glass door and the words "Ropichard" picked out in shining orange perspex across the stonework.
A wide lobby dotted with people in evening dress faced a line of metal sliding doors. Nina pulled an invitation out of her bag and showed it to what looked like hired help in a badly fitting tuxedo. Then she and Strike joined 20 others in a large, mirrored lift.
"This floor's for meetings,"
Nina shouted up to him, as they debouched into a crowded open plan area where a band was playing to a sparsely populated dance floor.
"It's usually partitioned. So, who do you want to meet?"
"Anyone who knew Quine well and might have an idea where he is."
"There's only Jerry, really."
They were buffeted by a fresh consignment of guests from the lift behind them and moved into the crowd. Strike thought he felt Nina grab the back of his coat like a child, but he did not reciprocate by taking her hand or in any way reinforce the impression that they were boyfriend and girlfriend. Once or twice he heard her greet people in passing. They eventually won through to the far wall, where tables manned by white-coated waiters groaned with party food, and it was possible to make conversation without shouting. Strike took a couple of dainty crab cakes and ate them, deploring their minuscule size, while Nina looked around.
"Can't see Jerry anywhere, but he's probably up on the roof, smoking. Should we try up there? Ooh, look there! Daniel Chard, mingling with the herd."
"Which one?"
"The bald one."
A respectful little distance had been left round the head of the company, like the flattened circle of corn that surrounds a rising helicopter, as he talked to a curvaceous young woman in a tight black dress. Phallus impudicus. Strike could not repress a grin of amusement. Yet Chard's baldness suited him. He was younger and fitter looking than Strike had expected, and handsome in his way, with thick dark eyebrows over deep-set eyes, a hawkish nose, and a thin-lipped mouth. His charcoal suit was unexceptional, but his tie, which was pale mauve, was much wider than the average and bore drawings of human noses. Strike, whose dress sense had always been conventional, an instinct honed by the sergeant's mess, could not help but be intrigued by this small but forceful statement of nonconformity in a CEO, especially as it was drawing the occasional glance of surprise or amusement.
"Where's the drink?"
Nina said, standing pointlessly on tiptoe.
"Over there," said Strike,
who could see a bar in front of the windows that showed a view of the dark Thames.
"Stay here, I'll get 'em. White wine?
Champers, if Daniel's pushed the boat out."
He took a route through the crowd so that he could, without ostentation, bring himself in close proximity to Chard, who was letting his companion do all the talking. She had that air of slight desperation of the conversationalist who knows that they are failing. The back of Chard's hand, which was clutching a glass of water, Strike noticed, was covered in shiny red eczema. Strike paused immediately behind Chard, ostensibly to allow a party of young women to pass in the opposite direction.
"And it really was awfully funny,"
the girl in the black dress was saying nervously.
"Yes," said Chard, who sounded deeply bored. "It must have been."
"And was New York wonderful? I mean, not wonderful. Was it useful? Fun?"
asked his companion.
"Busy," said Chard.
And Strike, though he could not see the CEO, thought he actually yawned.
"Lots of digital talk."
A portly man in a three-piece suit who appeared drunk already, though it was barely 8:30, stopped in front of Strike and invited him, with overdone courtesy, to proceed. Strike had no choice but to accept the elaborately mimed invitation, and so passed out of range of Daniel Chard's voice.
"Thanks," said Nina a few minutes later, taking her champagne from Strike. "Shall we go up to the roof garden, then?"
"Great," said Strike.
He had taken champagne too, not because he liked it, but because there had been nothing else there he cared to drink.
"Who's that woman Daniel Chard's talking to?"
Nina craned to see as she led Strike towards a helical metal staircase.
"Joanna Waldegrave, Jerry's daughter. She's just written her first novel. Why, is she your type?"
she asked, with a breathy little laugh.
"Nope,"
said Strike. They climbed the mesh stairs, Strike relying heavily once more on the handrail. The icy night air scoured his lungs as they emerged onto the top of the building. Stretches of velvety lawn, tubs of flowers and young trees, benches dotted everywhere. There was even a floodlit pond where fish darted, flame-like, beneath the black lily pads. Outdoor heaters like giant steel mushrooms had been placed in groups between neat square lawns, and people were huddled under them, their backs turned to the synthetic pastoral scene, looking inwards at their fellow smokers, cigarette tips glowing. The view over the city was spectacular, velvet black and jewelled, the London Eye glowing neon blue, the Oxo Tower with its ruby windows, the South Bank Centre, Big Ben, and the Palace of Westminster shining golden away to the right. "Come on," said Nina, and she boldly took Strike's hand and led him towards an all-female trio whose breath rose in gusts of white mist even when they were not exhaling smoke. "Hi, guys," said Nina. "Anyone seen Jerry?" "He's pissed," said a redhead baldly. "Oh, no," said Nina, "and he was doing so well." A lanky blonde glanced over her shoulder and murmured, "He was half off his face in Arbutus last week." "It's Bombix Mori," said an irritable-looking girl with short dark hair. "And the anniversary weekend in Paris didn't come off. Fenella had another tantrum, I think. When is he going to leave her?" "Is she here?" asked the blonde avidly. "Somewhere," said the dark girl. "Aren't you going to introduce us, Nina?" There was a flurry of introduction that left Strike none the wiser as to which of the girls was Miranda, Sarah, or Emma, before the four women plunged again into a dissection of the unhappiness and drunkenness of Jerry Waldegrave. "He should have ditched Fenella years ago," said the dark girl. "Vile woman." "Shh!" hissed Nina. And all four of them became unnaturally still as a man nearly as tall as Strike ambled up to them. His round, doughy face was partly concealed by large horn-rimmed glasses and a tangle of brown hair. A brimming glass of red wine was threatening to spill over his hand. "Guilty silence," he noted with an amiable smile. His speech had a sonorous over-deliberation that to Strike declared a practiced drunk. "Three guesses what you're talking about. Bombix, Mori, Quine. Hi," he added, looking at Strike and stretching out a hand. Their eyes were on a level. "We haven't met, have we?" "Jerry Cormoran, Cormoran, Jerry," said Nina at once. "My date," she added, an aside directed more at the three women beside her than at the tall editor.
"Cameron, was it?"
asked Waldegrave, cupping a hand around his ear.
"Close enough," said Strike.
"Sorry," said Waldegrave, deaf on one side. "And have you ladies been gossiping in front of the tall, dark stranger?"
he said, with rather ponderous humour,
"in spite of Mr. Chard's very clear instructions that nobody outside the company should be made privy to our guilty secret."
"You won't tell on us, will you, Jerry?" asked the dark girl. "If Daniel really wanted to keep that book quiet," said the redhead impatiently, though with a swift glance over her shoulder to check the boss was nowhere nearby, "he shouldn't be sending lawyers all over town trying to hush it up. People keep calling me, asking what's going on."
"Jerry," said the dark girl bravely, "why did you have to speak to the lawyers?"
"Because I'm in it, Sarah," said Waldegrave, with a wave of his glass that sent a slug of the contents slopping onto the manicured lawn. "In it up to my malfunctioning ears. In the book."
The women all made sounds of shock and protestation.
"What could Quine possibly say about you when you've been so decent to him?" demanded the dark girl.
"The burden of Owen's song is that I'm gratuitously brutal to his masterpieces," said Waldegrave,
and he made a scissor-like gesture with the hand not grasping the glass.
"Oh, is that all?" said the blonde,
with the faintest tinge of disappointment.
"Big deal. He's lucky to have a deal at all, the way he carries on."
Starting to look like he's gone underground again, commented Waldegrave. Not answering any calls.
Cowardly bastard, said the redhead.
I'm quite worried about him, actually.
Worried? Repeated the redhead incredulously. You can't be serious, Jerry.
You'd be worried too if you'd read that book, said Waldegrave, with a tiny hiccup. I think Owen's cracking up. It reads like a suicide note.
The blonde let out a little laugh, hastily repressed when Waldegrave looked at her.
I'm not joking. I think he's having a breakdown. The subtext under all the usual grotesquery is, everyone's against me, everyone's out to get me, everyone hates me.
Everyone does hate him, interjected the blonde.
No rational person would have imagined it could be published. And now he's disappeared.
He's always doing that, though, said the redhead impatiently. It's his party piece, isn't it, doing a runner? Daisy Carter at Davis Green told me he went off in a huff twice when they were doing the Balzac brothers with him.
I'm worried about him, said Waldegrave stubbornly.
He took a deep drink of wine and said,
Might have slit his wrists.
Owen wouldn't kill himself, scoffed the blonde. Waldegrave looked down at her with what Strike thought was a mixture of pity and dislike.
People do kill themselves, you know, Miranda, when they think their whole reason for living is being taken away from them. Even the fact that other people think their suffering is a joke isn't enough to shake them out of it.
The blonde girl looked incredulous, then glanced around the circle for support. But nobody came to her defense.
Writers are different, said Waldegrave. I've never met one who was any good who wasn't screwy. Something bloody Liz Tassel would do well to remember.
She claimed she didn't know what was in the book, said Nina. She's telling everyone she was ill and didn't read it properly.
I know Liz Tassel, growled Waldegrave.
And Strike was interested to see a flash of authentic anger in this amiable, drunken editor.
She knew what she was bloody doing when she put that book out. She thought it was her last chance to make some money off Owen. Nice bit of publicity off the back of the scandal about Fancourt, whom she's hated for years. But now the shit's hit the fan. She's disowning her client. Bloody outrageous behaviour.
Daniel disinvited her tonight, said the dark girl. I had to ring her and tell her. It was horrible. Do you know where Owen might have gone, Jerry? Asked Nina.
Waldegrave shrugged. Could be anywhere, couldn't he? But I hope he's all right, wherever he is. I can't help being fond of the silly bastard in spite of it all.
What is this big Fancourt scandal that he's written about? Asked the redhead. I heard someone say it was something to do with a review. Everyone in the group apart from Strike began to talk at once. But Waldegrave's voice carried over the others, and the women fell silent with the instinctive courtesy women often show to incapacitated males.
Thought everyone knew that story, said Waldegrave, on another faint hiccup. In a nutshell, Michael's first wife, Elspeth, wrote a very bad novel. An anonymous parody of it appeared in a literary magazine. She cut the parody out, pinned it to the front of her dress, and gassed herself. A la Sylvia Plath.
The redhead gasped. She killed herself?
Yep, said Waldegrave, swigging wine again. Writers, screwy.
Who wrote the parody?
Everyone always thought it was Owen. He denied it. But then I suppose he would, given what it led to, said Waldegrave. Owen and Michael never spoke again after Elspeth died. But in Bombyx Mori, Owen finds an ingenious way of suggesting that the real author of the parody was Michael himself.
God, said the redhead, awestruck.
Speaking of Fancourt, said Waldegrave, glancing at his watch, I'm supposed to be telling you all that there's going to be a grand announcement downstairs at 9. You girls won't want to miss it.
He ambled away. Two of the girls ground out their cigarettes and followed him. The blonde drifted off towards another group. Lovely, Jerry, isn't he? Nina asked Strike, shivering in the depths of her woolen coat.
Very magnanimous, said Strike.
Nobody else seems to think that Quine didn't know exactly what he was doing. Want to get back in the warm?
Exhaustion was lapping at the edges of Strike's consciousness. He wanted passionately to go home, to begin the tiresome process of putting his leg to sleep, as he described it to himself, to close his eyes and attempt 8 straight hours slumber until he had to rise and place himself again in the vicinity of another unfaithful husband. The room downstairs was more densely packed than ever. Nina stopped several times to shout and bawl into the ears of acquaintances. Strike was introduced to a squat romantic novelist who appeared dazzled by the glamour of cheap champagne and the loud band, and to Jerry Waldegrave's wife, who greeted Nina effusively and drunkenly through a lot of tangled black hair. "She always sucks up," said Nina coldly, disengaging herself and leading Strike closer to the makeshift stage. "She comes from money and makes it clear that she married down with Jerry. Horrible snob."
"Impressed by your father, the QC, is she?" asked Strike.
"Scary memory you've got," said Nina, with an admiring look.
"No, I think it's... well, I'm the Honourable Nina Lascelles, really. I mean, who gives a shit? But people like Fenella do."
An underling was now angling a microphone at a wooden lectern on a stage near the bar. Roper Chard's logo, a rope knot between the two names and 100th anniversary, were emblazoned on a banner. There followed a tedious 10-minute wait, during which Strike responded politely and appropriately to Nina's chatter, which required a great effort, as she was so much shorter, and the room was increasingly noisy.
"Is Larry Pinkelman here?" he asked, remembering the old children's writer on Elizabeth Tassel's wall.
"Oh, no, he hates parties," said Nina cheerfully.
"I thought you were throwing him one."
"How did you know that?"
she asked, startled.
"You just told me so, in the pub."
"Wow, you really pay attention, don't you?" "Yeah, we're doing a dinner for the reprint of his Christmas stories, but it'll be very small. He hates crowds, Larry. He's really shy."
Daniel Chard had at last reached the stage. The talk faded to a murmur and then died. Strike detected tension in the air as Chard shuffled his notes and then cleared his throat. He must have had a great deal of practice, Strike thought, and yet his public speaking was barely competent. Chard looked up mechanically to the same spot over the crowd's head at regular intervals. He made eye contact with nobody. He was, at times, barely audible. After taking his listeners on a brief journey through the illustrious history of Roper Publishing, he made a modest detour into the antecedents of Chard Books, his grandfather's company, describing their amalgamation and his own humble delight and pride, expressed in the same flat monotone as the rest, in finding himself, 10 years on, as head of the global company. His small jokes were greeted with exuberant laughter, fueled, Strike thought, by discomfort as much as alcohol. Strike found himself staring at the sore, boiled-looking hands. He had once known a young private in the army, whose eczema had become so bad under stress that he had had to be hospitalized.
"There can be no doubt," said Chard, turning to what Strike, one of the tallest men in the room and close to the stage, could see was the last page of his speech, "that publishing is currently undergoing a period of rapid changes and fresh challenges. But one thing remains as true today as it was a century ago. Content is king. While we boast the best writers in the world, Roper Chard will continue to excite, to challenge, and to entertain. And it is in that context..."
The approach of a climax was declared not by any excitement, but by a relaxation in Chard's manner, induced by the fact that his ordeal was nearly over.
"That I am honoured and delighted to tell you that we have this week secured the talents of one of the finest authors in the world. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Michael Fancourt."
A perceptible intake of breath rolled like a breeze across the crowd. A woman yelped excitedly. Applause broke out somewhere to the rear of the room and spread like crackling fire to the front. Strike saw a distant door open, the glimpse of an overlarge head, a sour expression, before Fancourt was swallowed by the enthusiastic employees. It was several minutes before he emerged onto the stage to shake Chard's hand.
"Oh, my God!"
an excitedly applauding Nina kept saying.
"Oh, my God!"
Jerry Waldegrave, who like Strike rose head and shoulders above the mostly female crowd, was standing almost directly opposite them on the other side of the stage. He was again holding a full glass, so could not applaud, and he raised it to his lips, unsmiling, as he watched Fancourt gesture for quiet in front of the microphone.
"Thanks, Dan," said Fancourt. "Well, I certainly never expected to find myself here," he said,
and these words were greeted by a raucous outbreak of laughter.
"But it feels like a homecoming. I wrote for Chard, and then I wrote for Roper, and they were good days. I was an angry young man,"
widespread titters,
"and now I'm an angry old man."
Much laughter, and even a small smile from Daniel Chard.
"And I look forward to raging for you."
Effusive laughter from Chard, as well as the crowd. Strike and Waldegrave seemed to be the only two in the room not convulsed.
"I'm delighted to be back, and I'll do my best to... what was it, Dan? Keep Roper Chard exciting, challenging, and entertaining."
A storm of applause. The two men were shaking hands amid camera flashes.
"Half a mil, I reckon," said a drunken man behind Strike. "And 10K to turn up tonight."
Fancourt descended the stage right in front of Strike. His habitually dour expression had barely varied for the photographs, but he looked happier as hands stretched out towards him. Michael Fancourt did not disdain adulation.
"Wow," said Nina to Strike. "Can you believe that?"
Fancourt's overlarge head had disappeared into the crowd. The curvaceous Joanna Waldegrave appeared, trying to make her way towards the famous author. Her father was suddenly behind her. With a drunken lurch, he reached out a hand and took her upper arm none too gently.
"He's got other people to talk to, Joe. Leave him."
"Mummy's made a beeline. Why don't you grab her?"
Strike watched Joanna stalk away from her father, evidently angry. Daniel Chard had vanished too. Strike wondered whether he had slipped out of a door while the crowd was busy with Fancourt.
"Your CEO doesn't love the limelight,"
Strike commented to Nina. "They say he's got a lot better," said Nina, who was still gazing towards Fancourt. "He could barely look up from his notes 10 years ago. He's a good businessman, though, you know, shrewd." Curiosity and tiredness tussled inside Strike.
"Nina,"
he said, drawing his companion away from the throng pressing around Fancourt. She permitted him to lead her willingly.
"Where did you say the manuscript of Bombyx Mori is?"
"In Jerry's safe," she said. "Floor below this." She sipped champagne, her huge eyes shining.
"Are you asking what I think you're asking?"
"How much trouble would you be in?"
"Loads," she said, insouciantly. "But I've got my keycard on me, and everyone's busy, aren't they?"
Her father, Strike thought ruthlessly, was a QC. They would be wary of how they dismissed her.
"Do you reckon we could run off a copy?"
"Let's do it," she said, throwing back the last of her drink.
The lift was empty, and the floor below dark and deserted. Nina opened the door to the department with her keycard and led him confidently between blank computer monitors and deserted desks towards a large corner office. The only light came from perennially lit London beyond the windows and the occasional tiny orange light indicating a computer on standby. Waldegrave's office was not locked, but the safe, which stood behind a hinged bookcase, operated on a keypad. Nina input a 4-number code. The door swung open,
and Strike saw an untidy stack of pages lying inside.
That's it, she said happily.
Keep your voice down, Strike advised her.
Strike kept watch while she ran off a copy for him at the photocopier outside the door. The endless swish and hum was strangely soothing. Nobody came, nobody saw. 15 minutes later, Nina was replacing the manuscript in the safe and locking it up.
There you go.
She handed him the copy, with several strong elastic bands holding it together. As he took it, she leaned in for a few seconds, a tipsy sway, an extended brush against him. He owed her something in return, but he was shatteringly tired. Both the idea of going back to that flat in St. John's Wood and of taking her to his attic in Denmark Street were unappealing. Would a drink tomorrow night, perhaps, be adequate repayment? And then he remembered that tomorrow night was his birthday dinner at his sister's. Lucy had said he could bring someone.
"Want to come to a tedious dinner party tomorrow night?" he asked her.
She laughed, clearly elated.
"What'll be tedious about it?"
"Everything. You cheer it up. Fancy it?"
"Well, why not?"
she said happily. The invitation seemed to meet the bill. He felt the demand for some physical gesture recede. They made their way out of the dark department in an atmosphere of friendly camaraderie, the copied manuscript of Bombyx Mori hidden beneath Strike's overcoat. After noting down her address and phone number, he saw her safely into a taxi with a sense of relief and release. Chapter 14 There he sits a whole afternoon sometimes, reading of the same abominable, vile, a pox on them, I cannot abide them, rascally verses. Ben Jonson, every man in his humour. They marched against the war in which Strike had lost his leg the next day, thousands snaking their way through the heart of chilly London, bearing placards, military families to the fore. Strike had heard through mutual army friends that the parents of Gary Topley, dead in the explosion that had cost Strike a limb, would be among the demonstrators, but it did not occur to Strike to join them. His feelings about the war could not be encapsulated in black on a square white placard. Do the job, and do it well, had been his creed then and now, and to march would be to imply regrets he did not have. And so he strapped on his prosthesis, dressed in his best Italian suit, and headed off to Bond Street. The treacherous husband he sought was insisting that his estranged wife, Strike's brunette client, had lost, through her own drunken carelessness, several pieces of very valuable jewellery while the couple were staying at a hotel. Strike happened to know that the husband had an appointment in Bond Street this morning, and had a hunch that some of that allegedly lost jewellery might be making a surprise reappearance. His target entered the jeweller's while Strike examined the windows of a shop opposite. Once he had left, half an hour later, Strike took himself off for a coffee, allowed 2 hours to elapse, then strode inside the jeweller's and proclaimed his wife's love of emeralds, which pretense resulted, after half an hour's staged deliberation over various pieces, in the production of the very necklace that the brunette had suspected her errant husband of having pocketed. Strike bought it at once, a transaction only made possible by the fact that his client had advanced him £10,000 for the purpose. £10,000 to prove her husband's deceit was as nothing to a woman who stood to receive a settlement of millions. Strike picked up a kebab on his way home. After locking the necklace in a small safe he had installed in his office, usually used for the protection of incriminating photographs, he headed upstairs, made himself a mug of strong tea, took off the suit, and put on the TV so that he could keep an eye on the build-up to the Arsenal-Spurs match. He then stretched out comfortably on his bed and started to read the manuscript he had stolen the night before. As Elizabeth Tassel had told him, Bombyx Mori was a perverse pilgrim's progress, set in a folkloric no-man's land in which the eponymous hero, a young writer of genius, set out from an island populated by inbred idiots
too blind to recognize his talent, on what seemed to be a largely symbolic journey towards a distant city. The richness and strangeness of the language and imagery were familiar to Strike from his perusal of the Balzac brothers, but his interest in the subject matter drew him on. The first familiar character to emerge from the densely written and frequently obscene sentences was Leonora Quine. As the brilliant young Bombix journeyed through a landscape populated by various dangers and monsters, he came across Succuba, a woman described succinctly as a well-worn whore, who captured and tied him up and succeeded in raping him. Leonora was described to the life, thin and dowdy, with her large glasses and her flat, deadpan manner. After being systematically abused for several days, Bombix persuaded Succuba to release him. She was so desolate at his departure that Bombix agreed to take her along, the first example of the story's frequent, strange, dreamlike reversals, whereby what had been bad and frightening became good and sensible, without justification or apology. A few pages further on, Bombix and Succuba were attacked by a creature called the Tick, which Strike recognized easily as Elizabeth Tassel. Square-jawed, deep-voiced, and frightening. Once again, Bombix took pity on the thing once it had finished violating him, and permitted it to join him. The Tick had an unpleasant habit of suckling from Bombix while he slept. He started to become thin and weak. Bombix's gender appeared strangely mutable. Quite apart from his apparent ability to breastfeed, he was soon showing signs of pregnancy, despite continuing to pleasure a number of apparently nymphomaniac women who strayed regularly across his path. Wading through this ornate obscenity, Strike wondered how many portraits of real people he was failing to notice. The violence of Bombix's encounters with other humans was disturbing. Their perversity and cruelty left barely an orifice unviolated. It was a sadomasochistic frenzy. Yet Bombix's essential innocence and purity were a constant theme. The simple statement of his genius, apparently all the reader needed to absolve him of the crimes in which he colluded as freely as the supposed monsters around him. As he turned the pages, Strike remembered Jerry Waldegrave's opinion that Quine was mentally ill. He was starting to have some sympathy with his view. The match was about to start. Strike set the manuscript down, feeling as though he had been trapped for a long time inside a dark, grubby basement, away from natural light and air. Now he felt only pleasurable anticipation. He was confident Arsenal were about to win. Spurs had not managed to beat them at home in 17 years. And for 45 minutes, Strike lost himself in pleasure and frequent bellows of encouragement while his team went 2-0 up. At half-time, and with a feeling of reluctance, he muted the sound and returned to the bizarre world of Owen Quine's imagination. He recognized nobody until Bombix drew close to the city that was his destination. Here, on a bridge over the moat that surrounded the city walls, stood a large, shambling and myopic figure. The Cutter. The Cutter sported a low cap instead of horn-rimmed glasses, and carried a wriggling blood-stained sack over his shoulder. Bombix accepted the Cutter's offer to lead him, Succuba, and the Tick to a secret door into the city. Inured by now to sexual violence, Strike was unsurprised that the Cutter turned out to be intent on Bombix's castration. In the ensuing fight, the bag rolled off Cutter's back, and a dwarfish female creature burst out of it. The Cutter let Bombix, Succuba, and the Tick escape while he pursued the dwarf. Bombix and his companions managed to find a chink in the city's walls and look back to see the Cutter drowning the little creature in the moat. Strike had been so engrossed in his reading that he had not realized the match had restarted. He glanced up at the muted TV. Fuck! 2-2. Unbelievably, Spurs had drawn level. Strike threw the manuscript aside, appalled. Arsenal's defense was crumbling before his eyes,
This should have been a win. They had been set to go top of the league.
Fuck!
Strike bellowed 10 minutes later as a header soared past Fabianski. Spurs had won. He turned off the TV with several more expletives and checked his watch. There was only half an hour in which to shower and change before picking up Nina Lascelles in St. John's Wood. The round trip to Bromley was going to cost him a fortune. He contemplated the prospect of the final quarter of Quine's manuscript with distaste, feeling much sympathy for Elizabeth Tassel, who had skimmed the final passages. He was not even sure why he was reading it, other than curiosity. Downcast and irritable, he moved off towards the shower, wishing that he could have spent the night at home, and feeling, irrationally, that if he had not allowed his attention to be distracted by the obscene, nightmarish world of Bombyx Morrie, Arsenal might have won. Chapter 15. I tell you 'tis not modish to know relations in town. William Congreve, The Way of the World. So, what did you think of Bombyx Morrie? Nina asked him, as they pulled away from her flat in a taxi he could ill afford. If he had not invited her, Strike would have made the journey to Bromley and back by public transport, time-consuming and inconvenient though that would have been.
Product of a disease mind, said Strike.
Nina laughed. But you haven't read any of Owen's other books. They're nearly as bad. I admit this one's got a serious gag factor. What about Daniel's suppurating knob?
I haven't got there yet. Something to look forward to.
Beneath yesterday evening's warm woolen coat, she was wearing a clinging, strappy black dress, of which Strike had had an excellent view when she had invited him into her St. John's Wood flat while she collected bag and keys. She was also clutching a bottle of wine that she had seized from her kitchen when she saw that he was empty-handed. A clever, pretty girl with nice manners, but her willingness to meet him the very night following their first introduction, and that night a Saturday to boot, hinted at recklessness, or perhaps neediness. Strike asked himself again what he thought he was playing at, as they rolled away from the heart of London, towards a realm of owner-occupiers, towards spacious houses crammed with coffee-makers and HD televisions, towards everything that he had never owned, and which his sister assumed anxiously must be his ultimate ambition. It was like Lucy to throw him a birthday dinner at her own house. She was fundamentally unimaginative, and, even though she often seemed more harried there than anywhere else, she rated her home's attractions highly. It was like her to insist on giving him a dinner he didn't want, but which she could not understand him not wanting. Birthdays in Lucy's world were always celebrated, never forgotten. There must be cake and candles and cards and presents. Time must be marked, order preserved, traditions upheld. As the taxi passed through the Blackwall Tunnel, speeding them below the Thames into South London, Strike recognised that the act of bringing Nina with him to the family party was a declaration of nonconformity. In spite of the conventional bottle of wine held on her lap, she was highly strung, happy to take risks and chances. She lived alone and talked books, not babies. She was not, in short, Lucy's kind of woman. Nearly an hour after he had left Denmark Street, with his wallet £50 lighter, Strike helped Nina out into the dark chill of Lucy's street and led her down a path beneath the large magnolia tree that dominated the front garden. Before ringing the doorbell, Strike said, with some reluctance,
I should probably tell you this is a birthday dinner. For me.
Oh, you should have said. Happy—
It isn't today, said Strike. No big deal.
And he rang the doorbell. Strike's brother-in-law, Greg, let them inside. A lot of arm-slapping followed, as well as an exaggerated show of pleasure at the sight of Nina. This emotion was conspicuous by its absence in Lucy, who bustled down the hall holding a spatula like a sword and wearing an apron over her party dress.
You didn't say you were bringing someone,
she hissed in Strike's ear,
as he bent to kiss her cheek. Lucy was short, blonde, and round-faced. Nobody ever guessed that they were related. She was the result of another of their mother's liaisons with a well-known musician. Rick was a rhythm guitarist who, unlike Strike's father, maintained an amicable relationship with his offspring.
"I thought you asked me to bring a guest,"
Strike muttered to his sister, as Greg ushered Nina into the sitting room.
"I asked whether you were going to," said Lucy angrily. "Oh, God! I'll have to go and set an extra... and poor Marguerite."
"Who's Marguerite?" asked Strike.
But Lucy was already hurrying off towards the dining room, spatula aloft, leaving her guest of honour alone in the hall. With a sigh, Strike followed Greg and Nina into the sitting room.
"Surprise!"
said a fair-haired man with a receding hairline, getting up from the sofa at which his bespectacled wife was beaming at Strike.
"Christ almighty," said Strike,
advancing to shake the outstretched hand with genuine pleasure. Nick and Ilse were two of his oldest friends, and they were the only place where the two halves of his early life intersected, London and Cornwall, happily married.
"No one told me you were going to be here."
"Yeah, well, that's a surprise, Oggy," said Nick, as Strike kissed Ilse. "Do you know Marguerite?"
"No," said Strike, "I don't."
So this was why Lucy had wanted to check whether he was bringing anyone with him. This was the sort of woman she imagined him falling for, and living with forever in a house with a magnolia tree in the front garden. Marguerite was dark, greasy-skinned and morose-looking, wearing a shiny purple dress that appeared to have been bought when she was a little thinner. Strike was sure she was a divorcee. He was developing second sight on that subject.
"Hi,"
she said, while thin Nina in her strappy black dress chatted with Greg. The short greeting contained a world of bitterness. So seven of them sat down to dinner. Strike had not seen much of his civilian friends since he had been invalided out of the army. His voluntarily heavy workload had blurred the boundaries between weekday and weekend. But now he realized anew how much he liked Nick and Ilse, and how infinitely preferable it would have been if the three of them had been alone somewhere, enjoying a curry.
"How do you know Cormoran?" Nina asked them avidly. "I was at school with him in Cornwall," said Ilse, smiling at Strike across the table. "On and off. Came and went, didn't you, Corm?"
And the story of Strike and Lucy's fragmented childhood was trotted out over the smoked salmon, their travels with her itinerant mother, and their regular returns to St. Maur's, and the aunt and uncle who acted as surrogate parents throughout their childhood and teens. "And then Corm got taken to London by his mother again when he was, what, 17? Said Ilse. Strike could tell that Lucy was not enjoying the conversation. She hated talking about their unusual upbringing, their notorious mother.
"And he ended up at a good rough old comprehensive with me," said Nick. "Good times."
"Nick was a useful bloke to know," said Strike. "Knows London like the back of his hand. His dad's a cabbie."
"Are you a cabbie too?"
Nina asked Nick, apparently exhilarated by the exoticism of Strike's friends.
"No," said Nick cheerfully. "I'm a gastroenterologist. Oggy and I had a joint 18th birthday party, and Corum invited his friend Dave and me up from St. Maur's for it. First time I'd ever been to London. I was so excited," said Ilse. "And that's where we met," finished Nick, grinning at his wife.
"And still no kids, all these years later?" asked Greg, smug father of three sons.
There was the tiniest pause. Strike knew that Nick and Ilse had been trying for a child, without success, for several years.
"Not yet," said Nick. "What do you do, Nina?"
The mention of Roper Chard brought some animation to Marguerite, who had been regarding Strike sullenly from the other end of the table, as though he were a tasty morsel placed remorselessly out of reach.
"Michael Fancourt's just moved to Roper Chard," she stated. "I saw it on his website this morning." "Blimey! That was only made public yesterday," said Nina.
The blimey reminded Strike of the way Dominic Culpepper called waiters mate.
It was, he thought, for Nick's benefit, and perhaps to demonstrate to Strike that she too could mingle happily with the proletariat. Charlotte, Strike's ex-fiancée, had never altered her vocabulary or accent, no matter where she found herself, nor had she liked any of his friends. "Oh, I'm a big fan of Michael Fancourt's," said Marguerite. "House of Hollows, one of my favourite novels. I adore the Russians, and there's something about Fancourt that makes me think of Dostoevsky." Lucy had told her Strike guest that he had been to Oxford, that he was clever. He wished Marguerite 1,000 miles away, and that Lucy understood him better. "Fancourt can't write women," said Nina dismissively. "He tries, but he can't do it. His women are all temper tits and tampons." Nick had snorted into his wine at the sound of the unexpected word tits. Strike laughed at Nick laughing. Ilsa said, giggling, "You're 36, both of you, for God's sake." "Well, I think he's marvellous," repeated Marguerite, without the flicker of a smile. She had been deprived of a potential partner, one-legged and overweight though he might be. She was not going to give up Michael Fancourt. And incredibly attractive. "Complicated and clever. I always fall for them," she sighed, in an aside to Lucy, clearly referring to past calamities. "His head's too big for his body," said Nina, cheerfully disowning her excitement of the previous evening at the sight of Fancourt. "And he's phenomenally arrogant." "I've always thought it was so touching what he did for that young American writer," said Marguerite, as Lucy cleared the starters away and motioned to Greg to help her in the kitchen. "Finishing his novel for him. That young novelist who died of AIDS, what was his..." "Joe North," said Nina.
"Surprised you felt up to coming out tonight," Nick said quietly to Strike, "after what happened this afternoon."
Nick was, regrettably, a Spurs fan. Greg, who had returned carrying a joint of lamb and had overheard Nick's words, immediately seized on them.
"Must have stung, eh, Com, when everyone thought they had it in the bag?"
"What's this?" asked Lucy like a schoolmistress calling the class to order as she set down dishes of potatoes and vegetables.
"Oh, not football, Greg, please."
So Marguerite was left in possession of the conversational ball again.
"Yes. House of Hollow was inspired by the house his dead friend left to Fancourt, a place where they'd been happy when young. It's terribly touching. It's really a story of regret, loss, thwarted ambition."
"Joe North left the house jointly to Michael Fancourt and Owen Quine, actually," Nina corrected Marguerite firmly, "and they both wrote novels inspired by it. Michael's won the Booker, and Owen's was panned by everyone," Nina added, in an aside to Strike.
"What happened to the house?"
Strike asked Nina, as Lucy passed him a plate of lamb.
"Oh, this was ages ago, it'll have been sold," said Nina. "They wouldn't want to co-own anything. They've hated each other for years. Ever since Elspeth Fancourt killed herself over that parody."
"You don't know where the house is?"
"He's not there," Nina half-whispered.
"Who's not where?" Lucy said, barely concealing her irritation. Her plans for Strike had been disrupted. She was never going to like Nina now.
"One of our writers has gone missing," Nina told her. "His wife asked Cormoran to find him."
"Successful bloke?" asked Greg.
No doubt Greg was tired of his wife worrying volubly about her brilliant but impecunious brother, with his business barely breaking even in spite of his heavy workload. But the word successful, with everything it connoted when spoken by Greg, affected Strike like nettle rash.
"No," he said, "I don't think you'd call Quine successful."
"Who's hired you, Corm? The publisher?"
asked Lucy anxiously.
"His wife," said Strike. "She's going to be able to pay the bill, though, right?" asked Greg.
"No lame ducks, Corm. That's got to be your number one rule of business."
"Surprised you don't jot those pearls of wisdom down," Nick told Strike under his breath, as Lucy offered Marguerite more of anything on the table,
compensation for not taking Strike home and getting to marry him and live 2 streets away with a shiny new coffee maker from Lucy and Greg. After dinner, they retired to the beige 3-piece suite in the sitting room, where presents and cards were presented. Lucy and Greg had bought him a new watch.
"Because I know your last one got broken," Lucy said. touched that she had remembered, a swell of affection temporarily blotted out Strike's irritation that she had dragged him here tonight, and nagged him about